From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Last week came the news that Chinese researchers have re-engineered the genes in human embryos. Not in mice, not food, but humans. A new technique enabled them to splice human DNA at a specific location for a specific purpose. Some say if safety can be improved, this kind of human genetic engineering could eradicate devastating diseases. Others say manipulating genes in embryos, human embryos, is crossing a terrible ethical line with designer babies on the way. This hour on Point, editing human genes. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What does it mean if, when humans become GMO, genetically modified organisms? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from New Haven, Connecticut, is Carl Zimmer, columnist for the New York Times. He wrote Editing Human Embryos, So This Happened, for National Geographic's blog, The Loom. He's author of A Planet of Viruses and Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea. Carl Zimmer, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
People feared this would happen. They feared it was coming just last month. A big call was put out from scientists saying, don't do it. But the Chinese did what exactly, Carl?
So what the Chinese did was that they created fertilized human eggs, and then as in the very early stages, when these were just little clumps of cells, they edited, or at least tried to edit, one of the genes in these embryos, basically seeing if they could change DNA in a way that might be able to be used to repair a genetic disease.
If this should work, what's unique about it is it will be passed down. It will be heritable from generation to generation. It will become part of the genetic code of that human line.
So if you can actually change the genes in an embryo and all the cells in a very early embryo, those cells are going to give rise to all the parts of the body of an adult, including the cells like eggs and sperm that they would use to produce the next generation. So yes, so if you were able to change that gene in that embryo, then theoretically it would be then passed down through the generations.
What is the stated goal of this particular strand of Chinese research? Is it disease eradication? What disease? What are they looking to do with this?
Well, this was just very basic research. They weren't really trying to do anything in particular. They were just looking at how this would work, this particular technique in human embryos. It's called CRISPR, and it's been used in lots and lots of other contexts in the last couple of years. Now, what you can imagine using it for is genetic disorders. Any mutation that causes a severe disease, let's say hemophilia, cystic fibrosis. I mean, there are thousands of genetic disorders, and then there are also genes that raise your risk of getting diseases later in life. Maybe the most famous one is the BRCA gene, which can drastically raise a woman's odds of getting breast cancer or ovarian cancer. If you can fix those in an embryo, the thinking goes, you spare that person those dangers, that suffering.
If we're talking here about eradicating disease, why such an uproar over this? Why was this found so shocking in the scientific community? What's been done here?
Well, there are many big issues here. I mean, one is, do we have the right to be tampering with the germline, to be altering human heredity? That's a big, big question, and you shouldn't just blunder into this kind of research without deciding whether that's a good idea. Another big, big issue is safety. This is a method, CRISPR, that's only a couple years old, and it's been moving at an incredibly fast speed in terms of development, but it's still early, early days. So if you were to be using a technique that was sloppy and could be potentially dangerous, trying it out on human embryos would be highly unethical.
And it's not just to eradicate disease. There's a big push on in China to find the genius gene, to try and, I guess, genetically engineer genius humans.
Well, you know, we human beings for a long, long time have had this kind of strange dream that we could somehow breed ourselves into sort of some sort of superior race. This came to be known as eugenics in the 1800s and was quite driving force in the early history of genetics research in the early 1900s. And unfortunately, you know, the Nazis embraced this very passionately, and we all know how that ended up. It's a risky kind of view of life that somehow you can tinker with a race by altering our genes, getting rid of, sterilizing people who have bad genes. Things have changed a lot, obviously, since a century ago, but there is still that kind of urge. And so there are, in fact, people who are looking for genes that could, you know, raise your IQ or lower your IQ, and then trying to figure out, well, okay, I mean, what do we do about that once we know about these so-called intelligence genes? That you have to bear in mind, we don't actually know them. Scientists are looking for them, but they haven't really pinpointed any really compelling examples.
And that's just intelligence, never mind all the other factors you could hypothetically engineer for. The Chinese ultimately, in this effort, they failed or didn't have full success. And nevertheless, you call this a historic moment in genetic research. Why, Carl?
Well, I compare it to cloning. So in 1996, there were Scottish researchers who announced that they had cloned a sheep named Dolly. And that was the first time that a mammal had been cloned and successfully born and was alive and apparently healthy. The fact is that Dolly was sort of the end result that they could show off after a lot of the eggs that they tried to clone failed. So it was a very crude process, but still they were able to clone a sheep. And today sheep animal cloning is almost a regular kind of thing. And so I do think that, you know, if people do eventually keep doing this, then we'll look back at this as being kind of a Dolly the sheep moment. It wasn't a very successful experiment, but they tried it and they did manage to edit some of the embryos the way they had planned.
The big call just last month saying don't do this, let's draw a bright line here, that was in several research journals, I guess. What is the call for a line? And is there any line at this point about what people can do or can't do?
Well, there are existing laws and regulations about doing experiments on human embryonic cells. So in some states, you can't do it at all. You can't use NIH funding for certain forms of this research. But you know, it's kind of open in the sense that, you know, those rules were sort of set up for earlier kinds of science. And now we've got CRISPR, and the regulations really aren't up to date for it. So these calls that scientists have made to just not do this kind of research using CRISPR on human embryos, it's more sort of a plea to people's moral sense to just don't do this because it's a bad idea. We don't have any laws in place really to enforce this.
CRISPR is the tool or process. How does it work? How are they suddenly having much more exact interaction with the embryo genes?
Well, what happened was that scientists discovered that bacteria were making some very interesting molecules that could zero in on the genes of viruses that were invading them. And they would grab onto a particular spot in the DNA and then cut it. And so these scientists said, well, wait a minute. I mean, if these bacteria have evolved this ability to zero in on a particular spot of DNA and cut it, well, we could use that as a tool. We could zero in on a piece of DNA in another cell we don't like and cut it out. And if we add in that the segment of DNA we want there in its place, the cell could just pasted it right in there. That was the idea, and incredibly, it worked. And it was just, I believe, 3 years ago now that they, you know, figured out how bacteria do it, and then went on very quickly to show that bacteria could do it, and then very quickly after that showed that human cells could do it. And now it's a real mainstay of scientific research, and there's a huge number of potential medical applications for it, setting aside all this, you know, human embryo controversy.
So, but on the embryo front, the genetics front, the heritable genetics front, humans now have the tool in their hand. Here's a little tape from NPR health correspondent Rob Stein talking about the concerns associated with gene editing experiments. CRISPR makes them possible. This is Morning Edition last week.
The other concern is sort of the bigger societal concern that this sort of thing could be sort of a slippery slope towards all kinds of like Brave New World kinds of things, including making designer babies where parents can pick the traits of their children to be smarter or taller or better athletes and, you know, essentially genetically engineering the human race.
Oh, that might be too far. But here's informational video from the biotech company BGI, Beijing Genomics Institute. The website here, the narrator celebrates making a better world for humans, maybe making better humans.
Today, BGI has been recognized as one of the world's leading genomics institutes. They continue to pursue cutting-edge scientific research with their ongoing mission of making a better world for the human population.
Looking for genius genes, here's a BGI scientist, Zhao Bowen. He's in charge of the project that searches for genes linked to human intelligence, talking with Wyatt Andrews of CBS News.
We're looking for the smart people. Those that has an IQ higher than 145 points.
And off it could go. Carl Zimmer, is this going on in the United States as well, this kind of research? Is there any ban on it here?
You're asking about research on intelligence?
Well, no. Yes, it could include that, but this general realm of human gene editing.
No, there's no research that I'm aware of actually going in and editing human embryos. But you know, people are looking at editing the DNA in human cells, and you know that what they learn working on human cells could eventually be applied to human embryos. It could also be applied to fighting cancer. For example, you can use CRISPR to edit immune cells to be able to go after cancer tumors better. And then you have a new tool for cancer.
Though you do it in human cells, that stays in that human. You do it in the embryo, and you've got it passed down generation to generation.
That's right.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Chinese scientists re-engineering human embryo genes and the ethical debate and warnings that has set off around the world. Not entirely successful yet, but they are right in there with new tools that allow a whole new horizon of what's being called gene editing. Carl Zimmer, is with us from New Haven, Connecticut, columnist for the New York Times. He's been writing about this for National Geographic's blog, The Loom. Lots of people paying big attention to what's going on right now in China and maybe elsewhere. It's an old science fiction theme. In the movie Gattaca, a potential future of genome editing was shown in a scene with two parents checking in with a geneticist about the status of their baby.
I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions. Premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want, I mean, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
We want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already.
That's Gattaca, science fiction. Let's talk fact and what's going on right now. Joining us from Worcester, Massachusetts, is Craig Mello, Nobel Prize-winning professor of molecular medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He won the Nobel Prize for his genetics research in 2006. Professor Mello, Craig Mello, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Great to be on the call.
And from Berkeley, California, Marcy Donofsky is here, executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society. Marcy Donofsky, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Mello, let's look at the opportunity here first, I guess. Do you see this thread of research as promising or threatening? And if promising, for what?
Tom, it's extremely promising. There are so many applications for this technology that are potentially of great benefit to mankind. Most of the applications that are really clearly ethical and are already moving forward would apply to genetically engineering cells for patients, in other words, adult cells, to correct disease mainly within stem cell populations that could then be reintroduced into a patient to correct their disease. For example, there are ongoing clinical trials using another form of this type of genome editing to correct or prevent human cells from being infected by HIV. to help effect a cure for patients with HIV.
How much, how soon do you see as possible? The Chinese scientists report that they had a very high failure rate here. When do we get around that corner, if we're headed around it?
Well, I think one thing that you have to keep in mind, you know, the genome revolution is new. You know, we humans have now a great new window into the inner workings of organisms and cells, and we are learning fascinating, amazing things about life and living things now. Human disease now is being linked to the level of genetic disorders at, you know, incredible pace of discovery. And these tools for mining information, what these things are, these are essentially search engines that cells have. And they're part of the cellular machinery. What Andrew Fier and I discovered was a programmable search engine that will search for, it'll use a short search query the way you would use your web browser.
You mean it'll to search my genetic...
Yes. And cells have these search engines of their own that they've evolved in order to be able to manage all the information that's flowing inside the cell. And scientists have learned how to enter search queries into these cellular search engines. So this earlier technology, RNA interference, was a programmable nuclease. So that is an enzyme that cuts RNA. Now we have a programmable nuclease that cuts DNA. And what's really powerful about this is we can synthesize our own search queries that will then enter into this machinery and find matching information in the cell.
What can you search for here? Are you talking about traits like eye color or height or hair color or you name
it? You can search for any gene by using essentially a short piece of the genetic code. In other words, the alphabet that spells out all the different genes in the human genome or in any organism's genome. You can search for those specific letters using a synthetic search query that will uniquely bring this search engine to that sequence. It's just like if you wanted to find Tom Ashbrook web page online. You type in your name into your web browser, and it'll take you there, right?
Are you using this CRISPR, Craig Mello? Yeah. Is it difficult? Is it effective?
It's incredibly effective. In essence, you know, this is the reason for the concern. It is very easy to do. And yet, the unfortunate thing about the Chinese study is we really didn't learn anything we didn't already know, in that we knew that it was error-prone and that there were issues, that it would take hundreds, perhaps, embryos before you'd get any that have the desired, or a few that have the desired modification. We really didn't learn anything new from this study. So I would say, first of all, we knew that it wasn't safe, and that's why you've heard this call for not doing this in human embryos. It's unethical to do it because it is simply not ready for that yet. But it is doable. So, that's why there's this concern in the community that it could be applied, and it would most likely cause more harm than good if people started to try to use this to modify human embryos.
Marcia Darnovsky in Berkeley, California. Not safe at this point, Craig Mello says, but he's an enthusiast on this front. Sees good outcomes down the road. Others may think of safety in different, broader terms here, not want to go down this road at all. How do you look at the frontier that's being opened here, Marcia?
Well, also am enthusiastic about using these new tools to help people who are sick. And I think that the gene editing tools are quite powerful. They're amazingly powerful. And we human beings have done amazing things with our science and technology, and we've done amazingly stupid things with our science and technology.
Yeah.
So I think what we need to do here is make a very clear distinction in our understanding and in our policies between using gene editing tools to help people who are sick and using them to try to create genetically modified human beings. And in fact, that has been done. In more than 40 countries, there are laws on the books and it also this exists in several human rights treaties, that we should not use genetic modification techniques to alter the human germline, not to use it to change the genes we pass on to future generations.
Let me be sure I understand the distinction you're making. When you say we should use it to help the sick, do you mean including genetically transferred diseases, hemophilia, cystic fibrosis, that you would change the embryo? You would genetically modify the human to take that out of that germline, that family line.
That's right. And that's why we should not be using this to produce embryos that are going to be used for reproduction. And here's the thing, Tom. We don't need these gene editing tools to prevent the transmission of inherited diseases. We already have a technique, an embryo screening technique. Mm-hmm. It's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD, that in the overwhelming number of situations can allow people to have children who are not affected by the disease that they're at risk to pass on.
Is that
and
just
also
an in vitro
that are fully genetically related to them.
In vitro fertilization you're talking about there? Or,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. But, of course, most pregnancies don't involve that.
No, but if you're going to be manipulating the germline, you would need to have the embryo outside the body anyway. So, you know, yes, PGD isn't perfect. It involves IVF, but it's far less invasive, far less biologically extreme, far safer, and far less fraught with social consequences than mucking around in the human germline.
If we do muck around in the human germline, and that's where the Chinese research, I guess you'd call it that already, what kind of social consequences are you worried about?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to draw a distinction also between research, and we have to find, there may be some scientific reasons to study human embryos and what happens if you swap in a gene or swap out a gene here and there. But we should not use those modified embryos ever to initiate a pregnancy and create a genetically modified human being.
Why not?
Because of the concerns that actually you and Carl Zimmer have mentioned, we would start, I think, and here's where I think we need not only technical expertise, but also we need to look at the social dynamics, commercial dynamics that would be put into play. And you can foresee, as many people have, including the policymakers who wrote those laws in the dozens of countries, you can sort of foresee that you'd start a genetic arms race, that wealthy people would line up, as you said, to purchase the latest genetic upgrade for their child. And not only people like myself, of whom there are many, who are very, very concerned and wary about this kind of scenario, but also many of the advocates have themselves predicted that you'd see the emergence of genetic haves and genetic have-nots. And, you know, we would be introducing entirely new kinds of inequality into the world and very likely followed by entirely new kinds of discrimination and social conflict.
A kind of essential inequality in the genes. Craig Mello, it's fascinating to hear this conversation. Here's Marcy Darnofsky and others so worried about that. You, on the other hand, have said that, you can imagine a future where, in the same way it's now considered unethical not to vaccinate your children quite widely, it would be unethical not to have a genetic trait improved if you could.
That's right, Tom. I think when you talk about germlines, you have to take a really long view. Germlines, the human germline is nearly 4 billion years old. And we're talking about, it's now 65 years or so since the discovery of the structure of DNA and the insights from all of this genomics and genetics are just really beginning to be useful to us, this new knowledge about genetics. I think, if it were safe and if we had the knowledge to make improvements in the human germline, then it might be unethical not to do so. And I think that the reason that that's worth thinking about is it's not science fiction anymore. This is something that is now possible. It's not safe yet, but someday it may be safe. I think given human nature, it will happen. And so I think it's great that we're having this discussion now. I can certainly imagine, as I'm sure almost any scientist you talk to could imagine, ways of improving. After all, the human genome is modified constantly through mutation. And most of the time, those are, you know, either silent or actually deleterious. So if we have a way of improving and repairing and making genes better, safer, healthier, you know, someday it may be like vaccination where, you know, you, if you have a child, you'll want to have these tests done and perhaps have a correction made. Now, I'm talking maybe hundreds of years from now. We are not there yet. The pace is fast, so it may be sooner than that. But even if it were to start today, you know, it wouldn't be earth-shattering. I mean, it's going to take generations before you see whether any of these, you know, modifications are beneficial. In fact, you know, we could, you know, this is not something that's going to happen fast. But there's plenty of time for the discussion to take place.
Well, we're having it right now because the issues are so large here. Talk about playing God or reprogramming our essence. Questions for the three of you. Jerome in Florence, South Carolina. Jerome, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I had a question about, of course, you know, these genetics are the building blocks of what we become. Mm-hmm. So what happens when modifying one thing, you know, we change something else that makes us undesirable? I mean, what happens when we try to take out a genetic a problem or for a bloodline, and then we end up creating something that later in years we find out that we don't want, a third eye or a sixth finger? And what do we do with our genetic mistakes? What do we do with the children that we create that we find out 5 years after birth that have something that is just totally undesirable as human beings?
Jerome, that's a great question. Carl Zimmer, can you take a first whack at that? That sounds like a very real question, given, I know it, things are advancing quickly, but still there's a lot to be learned in this arena.
Sure. It actually gets to a really important point about biology, which is that very often one gene can do several different things in our bodies. It can have roles in different parts of our lives. And so if you're zeroing in on one part, you say like, oh, look at this. This gene, for some reason, if this gene has this mutation, it protects us against Alzheimer's. And we've actually found a gene like that with a mutation that does seem to be protective against Alzheimer's. Well, what else does the gene do in the body? And how would that mutation affect what that gene does in those other contexts? This is just a fact of biology. And so before anybody starts tinkering around with genes in any context, whether it's tinkering with embryos or just doing gene therapy in adults, you have to understand the full effect that genes have on our biology.
Craig Mello, what about what would look like enormous room for unintended consequences to Jerome's question?
Absolutely. Jerome, you hit it right on the head. You know, that's the problem. We do not know enough at this point to be intelligent about which changes are beneficial and what the consequences will be long term. This is why it's unethical. Even if it were possible to do it, efficiently, which it's not, but in the future, even if it were, there are these, a great deal of potential for unintended consequences. So, you know, we're not ready for this yet, I don't think.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Chinese scientists re-engineering human embryo genes and the ethical debate and warnings that has set off around the world. Craig Mello is with us, Nobel Prize winner, professor of molecular medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. Won that prize in 2006. Marcy Darnofsky is with us from Berkeley, California, executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley. Carl Zimmer's here from New Haven, Connecticut, columnist for the New York Times. John in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you for calling, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am a physician and a psychiatrist. And some of my point was raised by the previous caller, but I think just for general knowledge, we now don't look at genes anymore as just simple things that account for something. They're really switches. And when you flip a switch, it sets up a whole chemical and electrical cascade of consequences throughout the body and the brain, which is one of the reasons why it takes 3 weeks for some antidepressants to work, because it takes that long for all the switches to go on and off as a result of preceding switches that went on and off. So that there are many far-reaching effects of any change of a switch. And so, just as with the prior caller, my concern is that when you do these switch changes, what is going to happen in the rest of the body? And including that in the germline is particularly of concern to me. While the risk of Huntington's chorea in an adult to be changed, that the consequences of the switch might not be nearly as disastrous as the disease. But if you put it into the germline, then you're really flirting with disaster.
So within one lifetime, genetic manipulation to address disease, you're all right with as a physician, but in the germline, where it's across generations, something else entirely. Marcy Darnofsky, it is a version of the same question we had, but I'm still fascinated by this for on two fronts. One, what about unintended consequences if we get in here? And then I'm just curious what you're thinking, because you're saying don't even go there, and yet in China, they're working on it, and here's Craig Mello with the Nobel Prize saying we should go there. That sounds like it's not so likely that we won't, Marcy.
Well, you know, I don't think there's anything inevitable here. We already have dozens of countries that have passed laws and have agreed and have thought this through and have realized that this is not talking about editing the human germline or modifying the human germline is not really a medical treatment. We're not talking about a medical treatment here. We're talking about something that creates a certain kind of person. They're very different kinds of things. And I think we can make a distinction between research and application here. And it is very analogous to the issue of human reproductive cloning that Carl Zimmer brought up. President Obama, in 2009, when he lifted the previous administration's funding restrictions on human embryonic stem cell research, made a really clear distinction. He said, we're going to research cloning in human materials under tight regulation and oversight, but we are not going to do human reproductive cloning. We're not going to produce cloned human beings. And he said that this was dangerous, and he said it was profoundly wrong in this society and any other society.
Is it formally prohibited in this country, Marcy?
In some states it is, but, you know, we have such political dysfunction in this country that we have not been able to pass a federal law against human reproductive cloning. We need one, and we also need a federal law against human germline modification. We need to join all those other countries, including China, that have either very strong policy or codified as law that prohibition. We need to stop being the outlier. We're the only country with a really robust biotech sector that doesn't have such rules in place.
We talked with Mara Visvendal, who's a correspondent with Science Magazine. She's covered China for a long time. Of course, this research we're talking about today happened at one of the top universities in China. But Mara said there are unconfirmed reports that there are four other groups in China working on this procedure, but we don't even know where. I mean, Marcy, what? You get a lot of this work going on, whatever the formal legality of this is. I mean, they're looking for genius genes. That's not for no reason. Do you get into a kind of GMO, human GMO arms race here?
Well, that's exactly the concern, which is why, you know, it's so important that we're having conversations like this one to really clarify what's at stake and to clarify where the bright lines are, where we should say, there might be a legitimate reason for this research. And also there are some bad applications. So let's do the things that are beneficial and let's say that the other ones are off the table. Let's make that agreement. And, you know, if somebody violates that agreement or violates that law, then, you know, there are consequences to that individual. But we're not going to set our society on that road towards, a new Gattaca or a new kind of eugenics.
I just think it's hard to keep it off the table. Craig Mello, we have scientists like you. I think you told my producer that in 100 years, if our civilization is still around, that we're looking at a future where humans will be able to improve the human germline, reduce disease, extend lifespan, and you think that would be a good thing. You're a respected Nobel Prize-winning researcher. Marcy says draw a bright line, but it sounds as though you're already prepared to step over it as soon as it's possible and safe to do so, whatever safe means.
Sure, why not? If it's safe to do so, that means that there's no longer an ethical concern. However, as all the callers also pointed out, you know, in order to do this safely, we need to know so much more. We need to both improve the technology, but we also need to understand the genetic basis of all of these things that we're talking about improving. You know, how do we, you know, is there a gene for intelligence? I don't think so. I think it's much more complicated than any single gene. And, I think we're still very, very far away. I'm taking a much longer view, I think, than most people, you know, take.
100 years doesn't sound like a long time when you're talking about changing the human germline.
That's right. 100 years is a long time considering the pace of scientific research. I think if you look back 100 years ago at the state of biology and medicine, you know, it'd be pretty appalling compared to today. So it's really difficult to make predictions about when, if ever, this will be safe. I mean, one of the things that you have to realize is there is a revolution in genetics and genomics right now. Human disease can now be studied much more effectively, much more rapidly. The applications of these technologies in the laboratory are absolutely revolutionizing medicine. And that's what people really need to understand. Of course, one of the things that's come from this technology is this ability to modify the human germline. We didn't really have that before. Now we have that. I think I'm not an advocate for it in its current state because it's just not safe and it's unethical given our current knowledge. Someday it may be ethical to do it. The fact is we can do it, and knowing humans, we will do it. So that's why we really need to have this debate. We'll do it, whether it's safe or not, unfortunately. I think that's, if you just look at the history of mankind, it's clear that whenever we develop a technology, we use it.
Do you see the same social consequences that Marcy foresees or dreads, a kind of separation then of humans into the genetically enhanced and the other, the sort of uber class of, you know, uber genetic powers and the natural class, which at that point would be lesser, sort of, I guess, the servant class to the supermen and women?
Well, I don't really see that, but I already see huge inequalities that are only getting worse in terms of the access to, the cutting edge healthcare that's available. These are issues that society is going to have to grapple with, whether we engineer embryos or not. They're going to be technological solutions to a lot of problems that will only be available to the very wealthy. They'll be surgical, and there'll also be stem cell therapies that are only available to the very wealthy. These are issues that society is going to have to grapple with. There are many, many, many important big issues facing mankind, and so this is one of them, and it's a new one, and we need to talk about it, but I think it's inevitable.
Carl Zimmer, it sounds like a moral nightmare. I mean, it took 4 billion years, as Craig says, for us to evolve. We're talking here about a century or two or whatever it might be, and we know the limits of human wisdom. At least evolution, arbitrary and mutation-prone as it might be sometimes, we have the sense of it being carried out by a higher power than our own feeble, flawed ways, self-designing, Carl.
Well, evolution is a pretty brutal way to produce new kinds of genomes. I mean, you know, evolution depends a lot on natural selection, which involves a lot of individuals dying or failing to reproduce. You know, it's not as if we haven't already been comfortable with altering the genomes of animals and plants around us, which we've done quite radically. So, but, you know, so it is a legitimate question, like, should we be doing that to ourselves? I would add, though, that, you know, we've been bringing up intelligence over and over again. That's like the real sexy item. I don't honestly believe we'll ever be able to do a kind of Gattaca type thing. I just don't believe it. I mean, you look
Chinese
at
are pouring a lot into it.
Now, China, yes. Will anything come of it? I doubt it. If you look at the research on genes that we know that intelligence is there's a genetic component to intelligence. So we know that when we look at twins and families and so on. But when you actually try to find the genes, it's very hard to find any genes with any really reproducible effect. And so what that probably means is that there are hundreds or maybe thousands of genes, maybe pieces of DNA that aren't actually protein-coding genes at all, that are working in an incredibly complex network. And also, they have their effects in particular kinds of environments. So to think you can just go in and say, like, oh, I'm going to press that button and I'm going to get an Einstein out of here, that's just not going to happen. And so honestly, like, sometimes I feel that these discussions about Gattaca are a real distraction from what we should realistically be discussing about what could or couldn't happen with this kind of technology.
Amy in Enterprise, Alabama. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an ecologist, so I'm kind of looking at this from, you know, history of human evolution perspective, kind of like the last speaker just mentioned. And, you know, the way evolution works, natural selection, it's not just necessarily, you know, a bummer for the individual, but, you know, there are individuals that are more adapted to new environments. So you look at the evolution of our planet, you know, it started with, you know, the original bacteria. Oxygen was a poison to them, but there were a handful of cells that could thrive under that environment and thus, you know, begat our lineage.
Where are you taking us with this, Amy? Where are you headed here?
Well, the question is, you know, once we start snipping pieces of our genetics, what future environments are we not going to be adaptable to? And, you know, we've got other issues facing us, you know, global climate change, this kind of thing. So, you know, could this be, you know, a bigger issue in the future that we're just reducing our adaptability by perfecting our adaptability to this particular environment that we're living in this century?
Got it. Amy, thank you. Marcy, what about it? You hear Amy's question, and I guess I'd add on that from what we've heard, the suggestion here is that evolution is pretty brutal and has its own problems. Will we be consciously better than evolution if we apply our intelligence to this and start doing human engineering on human genetics?
I think the time scale point is a really relevant one. 4 billion years to evolve the human germline. We've known the sequence, sort of the human genome for about 15 years. You know, should we really be do we really think we can do better than evolution? I don't think so. But I wanted to make a quick point about something I noticed about this conversation and a lot of conversations actually about this is that we tend to slide between, oh, that will never happen, that can't be done, and in the next paragraph, it's inevitable.
So I'm hearing, you know, more of the latter today, honestly, between the tools and the celebration and the rhetoric that, yeah, it's inevitable and we should do it or have the responsibility. I don't feel in the midst of all that this bright line holding that you're talking about, Marcy.
Well, it is the law, and we do have other laws that hold pretty well. You know, we didn't used to have laws against slavery. In fact, we didn't used to have laws against murder. And now we do. And sometimes those laws are broken. And when they're broken, we reassert the line. We say, this is what we do as a society. This is as a morally evolved society and a politically and socially evolved species. These are the choices that we have decided to make. And we're at that point now with this powerful new technology. And it's not just a question of whether it's safe. And to say that if it's safe, that then there are no ethical concerns, I think is to overlook a lot of what makes us human, a lot of the social and moral qualities that we have as a species. And that's, I think, where we have to go in this discussion.
Carl Zimmer, is there another step internationally that might lead to a firm global prohibition on this? Or do you see people sort of taking off in their own directions?
Well, it would have to be something that would be, you know, organized by some type of international organization. I mean, but I'm not sure if an organization like the United Nations is really equipped to handle it. I think
the United
it would be going
Nations
different
has
directions.
Taken this on. In fact, UNESCO has put out a declaration that says we should not alter the human germline. The Council of Europe has a binding international treaty that says the same thing.
Is that a firm prohibition or a kind of Maginot line, Marcy?
It's a firm prohibition. Countries signed on to it. They've ratified it. It's a treaty.
It's time to pay attention. The horizon may be long, but not that long. The tools we're talking about being used right now in the research, very startling, out of China and maybe beyond. Big issue on the table, humanity. Going to have to really work it through. Marcy Darnovsky at the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley, California. Thank you very much for being with us today, Marcy.
Thank you very much.
Craig Mello at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Massachusetts. Professor Mello, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Carl Zimmer at the New York Times. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you, Tom.
This is On Point.